All right, so the point here is to realize that the reason these laws were made is because of the belief that communism held about the nature of the proletariat, about the people groups, about how they handled themselves as far as what it meant to be a collective farmer. They thought that the city or the nation state could actually take care of the people and could manage all of their needs. What ends up happening is the greed of the nation state, that is the Soviet Union, becomes more important than the needs of the people. The Ukraine, which used to be the breadbasket of all of Western Europe, becomes a killing field. People die by the gross, by the thousands, by the tens of thousands. As a matter of fact, while all of the grain is being shipped out of the Ukraine, about 800,000 metric tons a year, millions of people die. As a matter of fact, in 1 year, over 7 million peasants die because of the policies of the Soviet Union that are placed on the Ukraine. All because of an ideology. And my point here is that ideas have consequences. Knowledge, or what you think of as knowledge, has consequences. The way we think about what is true and what is false, what we know, what we don't know, what we believe, all of those things have consequences. And education, as a discipline, holds to the fact that what we are actually trying to get you to do is to think about reality, to think about knowledge, to think about consequences. And the way we go about it is so important. Because if we believe that we know in a certain way or a certain paradigm, we're going to hold to that way of doing education. And then that's going to drive a certain method, which is going to have certain outcomes. Outcomes that could be very similar, given a certain paradigm, as the ones that were in the Ukraine, which is the death of millions of innocent peasants. So education isn't just a hoop that you have to jump through, as many of you feel like it is, and I understand that. I felt like that in college. I remember thinking, what is the dumbest class that I can take to get through math and still focus on my major? Right, for all of you, it's Nature of Math. And I love it when I see, I know, don't lie, I know what it is, but my favorite is Nature of Math isn't good enough for all of you. I see people actually posting on Bubs saying, which is the easiest Nature of Math class to take? I think, is there such a thing as easier Nature of Math class? Isn't it just by its nature easy? Sorry, I didn't mean to be punny, it just was there. And so I was just wondering, why is it that you do that, right? You think, no, I don't need to know math. I just need to go do my major. I don't need to know these certain things. I'm just trying to get out and jump through these hoops as quickly as possible. And sometimes even your majors encourage that, right? They say, why are you in Tory? Or why are you taking this? Or why are you taking that harder class? What are you thinking? You should focus on your major. You'd be so much better if you just focused on your major more. And it's true in one sense, right? You'd have more time if you took the certain, bonehead science class, like I think in some places it's called, you can take rocks for jocks. Have you ever heard this? Right? So it's like how, it's just the geology class so that you can take it. I am going to fall, but not with that. So you can just take this class, make it through because it's just for all the football players. Bummer that Biola doesn't have a football team, right? It's just harder for all of you that are running around trying to find an easier class. But there's no football team to go to. You can't follow them around during registration and go, oh, okay. So there is this sense. Now, the other sense that's going on is ideas really have consequences, and it can be seen by the way things have developed ideologically in the United States. Here is a book called Crime, Criminals, and Criminal Justice. Real page turner. It was copyrighted in 1932, and here is what they say. And somebody left a postcard seemingly from 1976 in there. All right. It says here, And this is talking about what criminals are. It says, man is no more responsible for becoming willful and committing a crime than the flower for becoming red and fragrant. In both instances, the end products are predetermined by the nature of protoplasm, there's a word you use every day, and the chance of circumstances. Personality is not a byproduct of divine grace, but a system of more or less integrated body habits. So now you no longer are culpable, given this book, for your actions. I'd like to take blame for the fact that I cheated during the test, but it was my protoplasm that got ahead of me. Now, it's easy to laugh at something as silly as this because of the lack of sophistication in one sense of what they're saying, but this is a scholarly book. This comes from an interlibrary loan from the University of Riverside. Which are we woohooing? Interlibrary loan, University of Riverside, by a reputable company, okay?
What year was it
published? 1932. So they were saying here, so what we have is this commitment, this fidelity to science being the foundation for knowledge. And it develops out of this idea. So to talk about someone's guilt, to make a value statement about something, is really false in light of this view. Because you can't talk value, you can't talk ethics, except in some sort of cause and effect methodology, if you hold to this kind of ideology. You just can't do it. So education has consequences. So there are people running around today that may not check out this book because it doesn't have the right sort of nomenclature, it doesn't have the right kind of language anymore, but that fundamentally believe the same thing about humans, is that all you are is a mechanism. And guilt, whatever that is, really doesn't exist. Because why? Well, there's no such thing because all you are is a reaction to your external stimuli. That's all you are. So when you commit a crime, there really is nothing that you're culpable for because your actions aren't even willful. Think about that. Your actions aren't even willful. So it is in the same sense that you're no more culpable than a flower is becoming red and fragrant. How bizarre is that? But yet, that's what these people hold. And really, this is a deadly legacy that is overarching all of the way that we think today. The university, well, I should stop and say, I want you to realize that today, you are under enormous pressure by two sources of knowledge, or at least two culturally acceptable supposed sources of knowledge. One is the research university, and two is the media. And oftentimes, they work hand in hand. First, to start and talk about the university system, it's interesting if you stop and think about what does a university do? What's it for? Why is it called research? Because the expectation is that mankind will aggressively be able to understand himself better and better through this process called research. No one ever calls universities knowledge universities because they're not. And I'm not saying something mean about them in the sense that I'm saying, oh, they're bad. I'm saying that's not their project. Even though you think that you go to a university and you get knowledge, that's what we commonly think, you really don't. What you end up doing when you go to a university is getting research and what is accepted by a guild as proper. So it doesn't even have to be knowable in the robust sense. It just has to be agreed upon in the sociological sense. So what you do is you get a bunch of people in the room that say are sociologists or mathematicians or artists, and what they all do is they say, okay, now this constitutes knowledge. And then they agree that their guild will go about doing this work in this certain prescribed way. And then when you do it in this certain prescribed way, that constitutes knowledge inside that guild. Whether or not it actually has anything to do with what's true is a different question, because truth becomes a measurement of properly obtaining to the expectations of the guild. Now, this happens all the time, like in art. And there's nothing wrong with it, because there are standards that guilds need to have. So you can say something is a good piece of art and still be ugly. Because what does it mean? It means that you've done certain prescribed things that the guild expects of you, and it's a technical statement about how well something is done, how it comports to the expectations of the artist community. And you can have, and artists say this, look, you can have ugly art, and you can do this in film, right? You can have technically really good films, but that are intentionally doing ugly things. And that's okay, but to make claims about the overarching nature of the work is a totally different question. So to say, was that film beautiful? Or was that art beautiful? Is a different kind of question. Now, oftentimes it's confused. I should point this out right away. It's confused. People think that when I say, is it beautiful, what I mean is, does it technically comport itself to the expectations of the guild? So I use the term beautiful, and they think, oh, yeah, of course it's beautiful. Look at that, how the camera comes in and does these kinds of things and has this right angle, and look at the lighting, et cetera, et cetera. Look at the way the film was edited, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it's beautiful. And I'm like, but people are throwing up. And it's ugly, and people are dying, and they're like, yeah, it's awesome. And you're like, okay, awesome I'll go for, technically well done I'll go for, but is it beautiful? And they're like, well, to me it is. And I say, okay, that's a different problem, isn't it? Is the film itself actually showing something beautiful, or is it just showing something technically well done? And I don't want you to be conflating the nature of the thing, in other words, at its essence, and the technical expertise shown while doing the thing. But yet, we misunderstand all of the time that tension. And so people will come in and they'll start making claims about reality that are really based on the nature of the guild agreement. It's like a union. That's really what it is. There's a union of people that get together and just make these agreements. Sometimes they actually enable you to become a participant in truth. But sometimes they don't. Sometimes they have no real expectation of even getting to it. All they want you to do is know that there's a prescribed methodology by which you come to learn the trade. That's all they mean. So inside of a university, this is always going on. There's always this tension. It's very precise. How do you know that you know what you're doing? Trust me. When you do, if you go on and do graduate work and doctoral work, you will realize, in some level, how farcical this can be. Because what you learn is that you comport yourself not to the truth of your dissertation. You're not trying to even sometimes argue for things that are true. Or you might even realize in the middle of your dissertation, oh no, I'm not even sure if I agree with this anymore. And you think, yeah, shut up. I am going to finish right now and have a moral problem later. Because I want to get this thing done. And as a matter of fact, I know people that have been told that. Now, oftentimes when you get done with your dissertation and you're really hard and you look back on it later, it's sort of like for you guys, your freshman paper. You think, how did they pass that? What were they thinking? Does someone in the faculty drink a lot? Right? I don't know what they were doing. And that happens even inside of doctoral programs where you think, why did they pass that? Well, they realize you're also getting better. There's also an improvement sense. But there also is this sense that it's not just about finding truth, but doing it correctly, whatever the guild expects. So you get these big, long, gigantic lists that say, here is how a dissertation looks. Here is the kind of way you format it. Here's the the way you talk gender inside the dissertation. Here's the way you, you know, do the footnotes. Here's the way you do the bibliography. Here's the kind of paper you print it on. Here's the signatures that you need to have. Here's the time you need to submit it. And you just sort of march lockstep down these little rules, get everything done right, give your dissertation to a committee who's already overworked. They read it, sometimes really well, sometimes not so well, depends on the committee. And then you are granted this doctoral degree that says, oh, now he knows a lot in this area. See, that's what we think. What it often means is that you know how to navigate the guild well. And the first thing I tell people that go into doctoral programs is, the first thing you have to do when you hit the ground is you have to remember that, yes, good ideas are very important. Being smart, studying well, having things to say in class, very important. And making friends with faculty, really, really important. And everybody sort of goes in with this idealistic view about what it's going to be like, that it's going to be all these really smart people talking with each other about this doctoral work, and you'll be like, my life has been changed. I have found the place where truth happens. And what you find out really quickly is, no, it's like an academic country club where you have to make sure that you're properly accepted and that you wear the right kind of shoes and say the right kind of things and don't say the wrong kind of things. Because it's not about knowledge. It's not even about arguments sometimes in classes. It's about what's accepted inside the guild. I've been told two things, and some of you probably know this, that were eye-opening to me during my doctoral program. One, I'm in class, and I'm already making people nervous because, one, I got a degree in Torrey, not literally, but I was teaching here, so I'm reading all the books with you guys and getting my degree at the same time, in a sense. So I have all this, you know, I've read all this Plato, I've read all these different books, and so I occasionally would make people a little nervous. And I remember this one class where I asked this woman a question, and she turned to me, and so not the teacher, but just another student in the class, and she said, you know what? You are everything that is wrong with education. Oh, yeah. And I went, I just kind of raised my eyebrows. No, but that wasn't even it. And then I had from across the room, you go, girl. And I'm like, okay, I'm in like some kind of surreal moment here. And I look over at the teacher thinking, she's going to say, now wait, let's talk this out. And what do you mean by that? You know, it's a doctoral seminar, right? I'm expecting more. And yet, what happens? The teacher just looks at me. And I look back at the teacher, expecting something magical to happen. Like, bonding or something, talking, discussing ideas, clarifying what it meant for me to be, what was wrong with all of education. But no, that was pretty much where we left it and we moved on. Because I held to a certain standard of knowledge that meant that I believed that there were things outside of myself that I could know that were real, that you could actually get at through the dialogue, and these people were all critical theorists, which means that knowledge isn't about reality, it's about power. And so, as the hegemonic Western thinker in the room, and hegemony only means superior, by the way, but not anymore in education, it means bad guy who picks on people. So what I came to find out is, since I thought that Plato was good, and I thought Dante was a good idea to read, and, you know, these were all, you know, dead white guys, as they put it, and then, of course, I asked them, where was Augustine from, anyway? And then they said, shut up. I found out that I wasn't comporting myself properly to the guild. So it didn't really have to do with questions about knowledge. I naively thought so. So I had to deal with that issue. Another time in class, here's what happened. I am sitting there. We're talking about this gentleman is giving a presentation on ethnic diversity, and he uses the word ontology. And so I thought, oh, this is fun. This is a really good way to think about ethnic diversity and the sort of essential nature of human persons. How does that fit in this sort of philosophical discussion? And so I asked this guy after his presentation about what he had to say about ontology and how that helped him clarify his views. Well, my mistake, he really didn't know what the word ontology meant. He had it in a certain very narrow category, and so I asked the question to him, and my teacher interrupted and said, "That is just like a Western white male, that question." And I said, whoa, okay, did I misspeak? Because I went right into apology mode, because I thought, I must have said something that was bad. And so I backed up and I said, okay, I'm sorry, here's what I meant. Yeah, that's just like a Western white male. And there was just no way out of that moment because I was using the word ontology, which is again, craft of Western European hegemonic knowledge practices, which if you think about things as critical theorists, it's just a way of maneuvering around as power because there's no such thing as truth, there's only power. So if I just said, look, I just want to know what he thinks humans are, it didn't matter at this point. It was too late. I'd been turned off because I didn't craft my sentence correctly, and I didn't think, and it was my fault too, by the way. I should have known better than to make a statement. I got excited because someone talked about something that I thought, oh, this is really a good idea, and I jumped into it without thinking about the response of the audience that I was talking with, and that they didn't accept that category because they thought it was oppressive. So it wasn't about discussing ontology or truth or knowledge. It was about crafting myself properly inside the guild and comporting myself to their expectations. That's what happens normatively in universities. Now, there are some departments that are safer than others. You get a bunch of scientists together of a certain stripe. They really are realists, right? They really believe that there are some things you know and some things you can't know. Especially like biologists. There are just things out there that are biologically driven. Now, their expectations about what the outcome would be interesting to talk about, but at least they know that, you know, bodies work in a certain way. You can have certain expectations about bodies and you can understand how they work. But this really is a tension inside of the university. So it's not about knowledge, it's about expectations and the guild. Now, the media is also an interesting mechanism. Notice today how the media drives everything. So, global warming. Everybody has something to say about global warming. Movie stars, musicians. Sheryl Crow is now on a big kick that has something to do with using too much toilet paper and greenhouse gases, and I don't even want to know how those go together. And I'm thinking, Sheryl Crow, musician, dated the bike riding guy, and PhD in what? Biology? No? What? Oh, no degree at all. Thought lots, read books, wrote art? No. Okay. What has she done in this area? Oh, I guess nothing. But all of a sudden, notice how the media puts forth ideas like their gospel, and all of a sudden, you can't get away from it, and you can feel the crush of the media on certain topics that you cannot get away from. So right now, it's global warming, but it's been all kinds of things. A woman's right to choose, gay and lesbian issues. And you just keep hearing the ongoing, ever-beating, pounding of the culture through the mainstream media. Now, if that's not enough, what else happens? Well, the media and the universities sort of jump into bed together. And if you would go to, metaphorically, because what you see, if you go right now, if you Googled their main news page, and then you went to the science section, everything that comes out of research universities. Almost like, new discovery for this, new discovery for that, Parkinson's may be cured, you know, hair, you can grow it again, yada, yada, yada. Right. Wait a second, that might be real. Okay, but you see all of these pronouncements about knowledge events that have just happened because of the discovery of science. And they both sort of work together with each other. And the mainstream media has something to say for the 5 o'clock news. And these guys get more grant money. And you see how they work together. And one of the main things that's going on, especially within the scientific community, is their fear of losing grant money. So science has to be moving forward in an aggressive manner, or else they're going to lose dollars. So you have ID people or anyone that questions their work and their method come along and ask hard questions. Doesn't just have to be ID people, but ID people are really annoying because they put you in a position where you have to defend your research. And so instead of making arguments back, what do you start doing? You just start making hit pieces. You start saying how stupid they are. You just start saying, how could anyone who's sophisticated hold this idea? Well, you know, Bill Dembski seems like a smart guy to me. I tried to read his book and it hurt. I mean, there are just all of these different that they don't want to address. They don't want to think philosophically about their work. They only want to think about it in light of what? Their guild expectations. So, if you get caught in that, if you allow them to determine what the paradigm is, then you're in trouble. Because they're the ones that say what is true and what is not based upon their guild. And you've got to be really careful that you don't assent to their expectations of what methodology looks like. So here we have these supposed events of knowing coming out of our culture, coming out of the mainstream media, and driving the way we think about the world. C.S. Lewis talks a lot about this in probably one of my favorite books of his, and that's Abolition of Man. And Abolition of Man is an amazing book. It was a series of lectures that he gave in 1944, to what university, yada, 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 blah, blah, blah. Well, I didn't write it down. In England at the time, during the middle of World War II. And actually, what's really interesting about it is even Time magazine, in the year 2000, said, what are the top 100 books of the millennia? And Abolition of Man was number 43. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And so I'm flipping to see, what in the world? Yeah, but Abolition of Man, they thought, look, this is such an important book. And it's just this little tiny, teeny, thin book. Like, what, 100 pages, maybe? Not even that, right? And what Lewis is trying to do is he's trying to let people know that there's this problem. And see, he focuses on, in the first chapter, the writers of this thing called the Green Book. And the writers of the Green Book, it's actually a real book, and the book is actually called The Control of Language. So now you have inside scoop. Let's see. What's the Green Book's name? Yes, it's called The Control of Language by Alex King and Martin Ketley. And, and the problem is that I think the writers of the Green Book are responding to the emotive nature of their day. And they're really responding to the nature of the narrative that has been told by Nazi Germany to their people. And so they're saying, look, if you believe in these sort of narrative-like stories, these aren't grounded in reality. You can't make decisions on these kinds of values. See where it leaves us? So they want to remove all of the sort of emotional language, all the sort of the we are like language, the Nazi Germany, or the people from Nazi Germany, they are like the Ubermen. They are the supermen of our age. You are like them. And then, of course, what you do is you denigrate your enemy, call them less than they are, you call them rats. And this is the way that you storytell. You vilify one group, you uplift the other group, people emotionally respond, and then you get these kind of movements, which the writers of the Green Book are understandably worried about. But they think that it's the method that's bad, and they try to change the method so that the only thing that we can really know is what we know empirically. And anytime we try to make a value judgment, and the famous illustration in the text is Coleridge is looking at a waterfall, and one guy comes up to the waterfall and goes, "Oh, that's pretty." And Coleridge says, "Right, not pretty, sublime." And he actually says, "Pretty is a bad way of talking about a waterfall. That's substandard." Because pretty is not even beautiful, right? It's sort of below beautiful. And for him, no, these waterfalls, they're amazing, they're breathtaking, they're overwhelming, they are awe-inspiring. Sublime is the word you would want to use. And you can actually, Lewis argues, compare the two and say, no, no, this one's the right way of talking about it, and this one is the bad way. You shouldn't use the word pretty. What's your problem? Do you not have a full soul? Literally, there's something wrong with you because you don't know how to talk about a waterfall. You don't have the right attachment to this kind of beauty. But the writers of the Green Book think this is bad. They think there's really no way to talk about values because they're only subjective. So if you say, "I feel sad," all you're saying is, "I have an internal state of sadness." You're not saying that your feelings are actually truth-bearing. So if you watch a child who's sick, and you say something that's value-laden, that's feeling-laden about the child, all you're doing is talking about your own internal states of affairs, not about anything that's truth-bearing. And Lewis says, no, no, that's a problem. You should be able to say things that are value-laden, that are feeling-laden, that actually correspond to reality. You should, when you see a child sick, feel sad. If you don't, Lewis says, there's something wrong with you, because life isn't just full of external, empirical responses to reality, but is phenomenal in nature. That reality is something that actually you get at not just through your physical senses, but through your soul. There are these transcendent access points to reality that we all have that are necessary for our human survival and understanding. And if we don't access those, we are going to end up being the kind of people that are, by the way, easily swayed by bad narratives, by bad storytelling, like people that fall into line with Nazi Germany. You should be able to say good narrative, bad narrative. Good storytelling, bad storytelling. Storytelling in and of itself is supposed to be evocative. It's supposed to bring up emotions. But you can do it rhetorically in an evil manner. But you can also do it properly. So we see the Apostle Paul doing it. We see Jesus doing it. So it's not the method. It's the intention and the access to knowledge that you have and the truth-bearing thing that happens when you talk about it. So it's really important for us to think that knowledge is really something much bigger than culture is telling us. And the problem is that when we're in the university, so often we think about our lives in light of just getting that piece of paper. We don't think about our lives in light of moving forward and really understanding reality. We just think, here are these prescribed set of hoops that I must jump through, even in a Christian institution. We do this all the time. That's what I was talking about when I was saying, okay, nature of math. And again, we've all done it. Because we don't realize that our academic work is actually enabling us to truly understand how God put his universe together. So, about 4 months ago, my son had decided that he will not participate anymore in any mathematic work. He's 9. It's a little early to decide that because he decided that the multiplication tables are too hard. He hit that, you know, evil area where it's like 7 to 9. Do you guys remember that? How horrible that was, right? I just remember staring at 7 times 7. I have no idea. All right, just looking at it over and over again, and he just decided, this is way too hard. Kind of made it through the sixes because he cheated, you know, in his head, like he could figure out, like, 6 times 5 is a lot like 5. You know, so he's doing this kind of adding and putting things together. But he hit the sevens, and he just hit the wall, which I knew would happen, and he just decided that that he didn't like it. Now, this wasn't helped by the fact that his teacher decided to state in class out loud for everyone to hear that she did not like mathematics. Yeah, I was not a happy father. And finally I said to him, Ian, you will learn this. Oh, it's so hard, I can't. You know, the old I can't thing, the flopping on the ground, the, you know, the life coming to an end kind of, you know, you guys do that when you're writing your Tory papers, that kind of thing. And so, no, I cannot do this. What does Schubert want of me? It's that kind of thing. What is wrong with her? I have to talk to someone. Maybe Reynolds will help. So you get this. He's flopping on the floor. And finally I said, look, Ian, mathematics is like academic breathing. You have to know it. It is a fundamental way of knowing the world that you have to get a grip on. And this is just the beginning of this. And he's like, really? I'm like, yes. He goes, but what about my, I don't want to hear about your teacher. I understand what she was trying to say. She was just trying to sort of commiserate with, no, no, it's hard, and it's hard for me too. But I said, you just don't have a choice. You're going to learn it. But yet so much of our life is measured like this, where we think, oh, I don't have to know this kind of knowledge or that kind of knowledge, or what good is grammar anyway? Right, well, you'll find out really quick, right, when you get your paper back. But it is this expectation that these kinds of things don't matter. And part of it is driven by the bad way we measure success in our educational system. So another, to give you another example, my son is, well, he's got my sort of early neuromuscular skills, which means not that great for fine tuning, right? And it is funny because he's got a little sister who like has these great fine motor skills because girls just do. And so he's working on writing, and he writes like he should be a doctor someday. And I mean like a medical doctor. He's on his way because I'm trying to decipher it, and he's working really hard to make it neat. And then so he's working on his printing, right? So he's in third grade, early in the third grade, and printing's a big deal, and they're making sure they do it really well, and he's just freaking out about it, and he's working really hard, and his little sister's like, you know, look at mine, Ian. Thank you, honey. That's really helpful. And so what you find out is that right on top of third grade, there's another standard that comes on top of it, which is cursive writing. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly. Now, I will say, I hated cursive writing, right? I thought, what? The fall of man is some way deeply attached to this thing called cursive writing. I know, blah, blah, the lost art of note writing. I don't care. Okay? You will never get a note from me. You're lucky I know how to sign my name. Okay? I mean, I had to take the GREs. And in the GREs, I actually posted on this on the blog, but the GREs, you have to write like 2 full paragraphs about why you're not going to cheat. I was cramped because it's in cursive. And I had no idea what those letters, I didn't know how to write, and they print it. They don't even help you by showing it in cursive. They show it in printing, and then they make you write it in cursive. I'm cramping. I'm going, what's a capital Q look like? Is it the 2 thing? I can't remember. I mean, I'm not even stringing the letters together correctly. I'm just smushing them, like in one gigantic area, you know? So I get it all done, and I hand it in. I swear, that's the hardest part of the GRE for me. I'm like, and I hand this to the lady, and I'm sweating, and she's like, yeah, it's hard for everybody. I'm like, yeah, I wish someone would have warned me. I would have practiced that along with my geometry, right? I mean, I just needed to learn how to do it. And I come to find out, so he's already under pressure. He's doing his cursive writing, and he's barely doing, I mean, he's working really hard on printing. And so they add this, and you have like the best cursive writing on the whole planet. And so I'm not even talking to you. Anyway, just bitter. And so anyway, So he's working on his cursive writing, but it's, I mean, if his printing's bad, Sanskrit comes to mind. Some kind of, I think he should take up hieroglyphics, it'll be clearer. There's just a problem here. And finally, I went to his teachers and I said, okay, so what's, because they would do things like half of the paper has to be printed and half of it has to be handwritten, right? So the printing, he gets rid of that pretty quick. And the handwritten cursive one, I mean, I'm like going, all right, it's like 9 at night. You are going to bed. I don't care what's done. Because he's really trying, but he's just not very good at it. And so finally I said to his teachers, why are we doing this? And they said, oh, yeah, that drops off after fourth grade. You're kidding me. You mean we're going through all of this and it drops off after fourth grade? Well, yeah, they just want to make sure he knows how to read cursive. And I said, okay, reading and writing, I think they're two different things. And so I hold him up some cursive writing and I say, read this. And he reads it perfectly because he reads a lot. He's a reader. And I said, great, you're done. You'll never write cursive again. I go to the teachers and I say, he will never write cursive again. But they're like, standards. And I'm like, stupid. And see, the problem is that that's the kind of education we get caught up in. Is it? So here's an 8 to 9 year old boy just crying literally and being depressed about his academic skills, thinking that the world is coming to an end because he might get a lower grade because of his cursive writing, which is just going to be dropped at fourth grade magically, poof. Oh, you don't need that again. What? And so there's no way. He will never write cursive for the rest of his life, and he can blame me when he hits the GREs. That's all I'm saying. Good luck with that. He'll figure it out when he gets there. But I don't think his life is crushed because of that. In the same place, in third grade, in the standards, catch this. The students are actually to be able to discuss the relationship of their work in school with their personal human capital. Yeah, that's right. The students, this is third grade. Did you not learn this in third grade? All right, that's a problem with your education. Everybody homeschooled, I can tell. Discuss the relationship of the student's work in school and their personal human capital. Do you know what the word personal human capital actually comes from? No, it's an economic term. Right. So what they actually want the students to learn is how their hard work corresponds to their financial gain. That's exactly what they want third graders to start learning. That their hard work isn't, so they're not going to school to be educated, they're going to school to make money. I'm kidding, this is literally the standard for the state of California. So what you are teaching students to become are aggregates of capital that go into the economic machine that causes the state to be a viable player in the world economic field. So in other words, cog number 4, come over here. How's your cursive writing? Oh, that doesn't matter anyway. Get into line with everyone else because that's all you are. So by third grade, they're talking about this. They are causing them to think not about education as good in and of itself, but education as important for the economic might of the state or the nation. That's why programs like mathematics, that's why programs like science are pushed, because they make stuff. That's why humanities are abandoned, because what good are they for the economic growth of the nation? Other than like moral fiber and things like that, but that doesn't make me a toaster. That's all I'm saying. So the problem is here is that you get caught up in these expectations of standards. In the university, it's the same way. Why do you think you have certain general education courses that you must go through? Now, in a university like Biola, it's different, but there are still expectations about what does it mean to learn mathematics? Why should you learn science? What about science should you learn? At a liberal arts institution like Biola, we have an expectation for you to learn these things because we think it actually matters to your soul. Because to understand humanity is an important part of being the right kind of citizen. But in general, you have to be really careful still about what each guild that you're even involved in is saying about what knowledge is. And unless you understand what that looks like, you're going to get caught. Because every single expectation that's inside each guild has an underlying philosophical commitment. And so often you don't think about it. So who would think that a third grader would be caught up in this underlying philosophical commitment about the nature of human persons that's not derived on their soul, but on their market viability, which is just enumerating and mechanizing human persons by the third grade? In the same sense, you have to be careful about how you're being educated in any institution. What does it mean for me to know something? What does it mean to call something a fact? What does it mean to say that's true? These kinds of fundamental commitments are necessary for you, and you guys should be responsible to come to understand what does it mean to know these things. One final point, and I'll let you guys go. C.S. Lewis talks about some of this. In our English syllabus, and it's an article he writes, and he gives a paper to the English department at Oxford. And it's funny because it really doesn't turn out to be really about the English syllabus at all, but about what does it mean to be educated. And he says one of the interesting things is that we have this misunderstanding about what education is for. So often, we think that education is for, and even you guys do that come to Biola, think it's about getting a job. It's about an occupation. So when I get done here, I'll go get work and I'll make money. But Lewis says, what in the world are you talking about? Education isn't just to go get a job. He goes, you know, animals have jobs. He says, animals, he said, they are perfect working professionals. He said they would, if they could, talk, only talk shop to each other. Lewis states, lions cannot stop hunting, nor can the beaver stop building dams, nor can the bee make honey, stop making honey. And he's pointing out that, no, see, animals work, that's all they do. But humans do much more than work. But yet we so often get caught up in our education just being about our work. He's saying, look, that's an animalistic thing. You're totally missing the point. He says, humans are made for thought. They're made for inquiry. They're made for rationality. He says, humans are made for this idea of leisure. And what he doesn't mean laying around with like one of those pineapple-y things with the umbrella in it and the big straw on the beach. Well, that's not bad. He's saying, no, it's not about lazing about. It's about living a life where you do your occupation to make money, but you do this thing called your vocation, your life calling. And that's about learning. That's about understanding. That's about developing the kind of life that is an ongoing investigation of reality for God's service. And that's really what it means. See, we fundamentally misunderstand why we are being educated. And we've allowed ourselves to become a part, accidentally, of the university system at large in our minds and the media, because they talk about our lives in light of our work. And that's how people identify themselves, right? Hey, I'm so-and-so. What do you do? And we identify ourselves directly with, oh, I'm a professor at a university. Woo-hoo. Right? Oh, I make films. I do this. I do that. Is that really what you are in your totality? No. You completely misunderstand that what you are is a servant of the king in the kingdom of God. And you misunderstand that. You think that I'm going to the university just to get a job. And then go take a job in whatever field I pick. And that's sort of going to be the totality of my life until I die and I guess get to heaven. But that does not seem to be the way that God calls us to live our lives. We are a part of God's kingdom. He has given us insight on the reality of his nature so that we can serve him more effectively. There's an expectation and a responsibility that stands outside of us just making money. And yet, so often we allow ourselves to be caught in that trap. And it's a trap. So every day you're doing class, and you're just thinking, I will do the bare minimum so I can get out and get the job. Because really, that doesn't matter what my grades are, and that's where the lie starts. Because if you're serving God, it does matter what you know. It does matter what you understand. You'll shockingly find that mathematics actually matters when you're thinking about the kingdom of God. I had to discover this the hard way. I'm reading Bill Craig makes an argument in one of his books called the Kalam Cosmological Argument, and he uses this word called traversing actual infinites. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm in big trouble, because I had no idea what that meant. Well, that's a mathematical term about the nature of sequential enumeration. And I thought, I have to know that. My math skills are really bad. I'm bonding with geometry, and that's about it, because that's what I could get away with. And I came to find out that these realities, I wish I would have known this sooner. I wish I would have understood that my academic life isn't about my occupation and what I can get away with, but it's about my pursuit of God and His call. And you can't scrimp on that. Because our vocation is what we are. And that's people that are following God, that are purposed, all of you, to serve God and His kingdom. Now that may come about in different ways, and you may be able to meld your occupation with your vocation, but you cannot think of yourself solely as your work. If you do, what you've done is you're doing the same thing they're doing with my son's standard in third grade. You've allowed the system to tell you who you are. And you guys are smarter than that. And God has gifted you to go farther than that. So I want to encourage you to realize that you are after a pursuit of truth. And Lewis says this: truth is always about something, but reality is that about which truth is. Let me say it again. Truth is always about something, but reality is that about which truth is. You guys are on a quest for reality. We talk about it in terms of this thing called truth, which just means that if I say the right thing about the thing I'm talking about, if it corresponds to reality, then it is true. And that is what our life is about, that kind of investigation, to understand God's reality, how He put His universe together, and then that understanding how it affects me as a human being in His service. And I encourage you to think about your life differently, to think about your call differently, to think about God's desire for you differently. Don't let the world tell you what you should become. Don't get caught up in possessions. Don't get caught up in wanting more. And I know it's really hard living in this world, especially in Orange County and LA, where everything is bright and shiny and new. And you can find yourself, for unknown reasons, desiring things that you really don't need. I need a bigger iPod. 30 gigs, that's not enough. Or I found myself sitting behind a bunch of cars at my kid's school, and I'm driving my pickup truck, and every single car is an SUV of some sort. From a Porsche SUV to, you know, the Escalade to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, there's somebody in a Porsche behind me. I guess that doesn't count, but not an SUV. Well, there was a Porsche SUV there, too. But see, so the point is all of a sudden I find myself thinking, my life is incomplete. I don't have a Porsche SUV. I was actually thinking more about the Porsche itself. But I need to have something with a whale tail. That's important. But I find myself getting caught up in that and not realizing who God has called me to be. And that's because of the nature of the input on my life. And I want to read you this final thing, and we'll be done. This is what Dallas Willard says in The Divine Conspiracy about this. There is a weight, a crushing weight, of the secular outlook that permeates or pressures every thought we have today. Sometimes, it even forces those who self-identify as Christian teachers to set aside Jesus' plain statements about the reality and total relevance of the kingdom of God and replace them with philosophical speculations whose only recommendation is their consistency with a modern mindset. I want you to hear this again. It's the crushing weight of the secular outlook that permeates or pressures every thought we have today. And we have got to be aware of that. We have got to capture that. We have got to remember that that's going on every day. When we get up in the morning till we go to bed at night, you are being crushed by the weight of the secular outlook. And you've got to guard yourself from that. The only way that you're going to become truly educated and serve God in your right vocation is to understand this and call on Him to extricate you from the bad thinking that we all have. Let's pray.